I would like to encourage the younger members to come forth and ask questions of our panel, although not precluding those who are a little bit grayer on top. Perhaps some of those who are here on scholarships. We really would like to hear. I mean, you've been here listening to us talking at you. Please identify yourself and let's hear what your question is.
Hans Zeiger, Hillsdale College. And building on what Mr. Rosella just said about the challenge to hope, I sense that there are some signs of hope on the horizon. And if I could list a few of those, first of all, I think young people are rejecting political correctness. Brian Anderson talks about that in his book, South Park Conservatives. Robert Royal, number two, Robert Royal mentioned yesterday the fact that liberals are not having kids and conservatives are. James Taranto, Wall Street Journal, calls that the Roe effect. Number three, and I should add along with that, that the rising generation, young people, are the most pro-life generation. Number three, young Americans are highly interested in volunteerism and community service, I think more so than any generation since the World War II generation. Number four, our generation doesn't trust the federal government. We see it as obese, we see it unwieldy, it's fake and personal, it's full of elitist hypocrites, whether we're talking about Bill Clinton or Mark Foley. And so we look to, I think, local government as a viable alternative. Fifth, there is a conservative advantage in the new media, and I see that as something that's going to be picking up in the next few years. And finally, the 60s generation of cultural elites is about to retire, and there's going to be a void that conservatives ought to fill. So could you add to my list, help me build my list of signs of hope? Thanks.
Sure. And thank you. Thank you for those. The one I was thinking of, which I didn't mention, is a sort of more a tradition of or a developing tradition of a group of younger folks, some on blogs, some writing books, who are creating what I think is a helpful counter tradition that is going beyond the disputes in the 60s, 70s, 80s between conservatives and liberals. I'm thinking here of people like Bill Kaufman, who's been writing some very good stuff on rethinking our American tradition, focusing on some of the themes that you mentioned, but with a slightly different cast of characters and really trying to ground what conservatives believe in a clearly indigenous tradition that doesn't stick with the usual folks. So I would cite, I would add to that to your list.
To know with tradition, family, property for Mr. Sager, I come with a cheerful suggestion. Karl Rove's intervention with the Terri Schiavo case was not an appeal to religious extremists or anything like that. I think it was tapping into something that's very large in society. The end of life issues, the sanctity of life issues are very important to a lot of young people. And the cheerful note that I saw in the midst of that terrible tragedy, which was, in my opinion, the murder of Terri Schiavo, was a photograph of a little four-year-old boy walking towards the hospital with a cup of water to give to Terri Schiavo, and they arrested the kid. That's very cheerful to see a four-year-old going to take water to someone who is starving and dying of lack of water. And this kind of thing is not religious extremism. Who is going to make the four-year-old little boy into anything other than a very caring individual? And I think that's the kind of hope that conservatives can look forward to, in spite of what the media tell us, that we should just let the old people die, like they tried to do to my mother. The little children who come to the March for Life every year, who go to help people like Terri Schiavo, are a real hope. I hope you will take that into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I would say that I think the Terri Schiavo case, I mean, obviously the right to die is an issue that we're going to have to grapple with as a society, as technology makes it possible to keep people in a state that's almost between life and death for extended periods of time. But the Schiavo case wasn't about the right to die as much as it was about federalism and a perversion of federalism by the Bush administration and you know, it's not that the law was unclear, it's that the facts of the case were unclear, and the proper forum for that was the judicial system of Florida. And the judicial system of Florida came to its determination. Whether it was right, whether it was wrong, I wouldn't act as a trier of facts of that. But there was no reason, and I'm sorry, there was no reason but cynical politics for the Congress and for the president to fly back in the middle of the night to sign this bill and to inject Congress into the middle of one family's painful end-of-life decision. It was a shameful spectacle, and it did not, you would not want to see it as a political issue, I guess, in some ways, but I think it was nakedly political, and it was a big political mistake.
My name is Bob Weisberg. I'm hardcore academic, been doing it for 35 years, and during that time, I've operated safe houses for conservative students. As one of the few outed academics, they would come to my office, we'd pull down the shades and talk. And what I'm going to say is very awkward and quite embarrassing for the Republican Party. The one issue which, in my estimation, drives young college students getting into conservatism is affirmative action and the whole racial spoil system. These are all kids who have grown up in the affirmative action soup. They were all born when affirmative action was probably 20 years old. And they see it every day in many, many ways, not only with admissions to college, but how teachers give diplomatic immunity, and I plead guilty to that, to people who shouldn't be in college. They see it when they go to job fairs, when they see it when they walk around the university, they have centers for everybody other than white males, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know the story. And yet, the Republican Party takes a complete pass on this. The Republican Party, on almost every, as far as I know, time when they've been on the ballot in Michigan, California, when it comes time to face up to this double standard in the schools, these kids are without any political support. There are some organizations out there which I turn them to, but certainly not the Republican Party. And this is something which affects them economically. It deeply offends them, and the Republican Party is out washing their hair or doing something or shopping, and it's not there for them. And until the Republican Party faces up to this, these kids are not going to look kindly upon conservatism and the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, since I talked about my college experience, I mean, I think you are right. I mean, I was lucky when I was doing my activist journalism type of activities. You know, like I said, Mike Pence's office did reach out to me, but, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, the local Republican Party didn't, you know, I went to one of their meetings and they just were very confused by what I was doing and didn't know if it was too controversial and didn't really want it. It was awkward, I think is the best word to describe it. But certainly, I mean, there are kids out there that know there's something that needs to be changed. But, you know, there's so many other options on campus that seem more attractive where they can, you know, like I use the word coddled. And it's a major source of frustration for me to watch potentially good people get sucked into other avenues where I think they could be really effective as political activists. And so, you know, when you see kids like that, like I said, you know, there's a woman that would have me over for dinner and she would just kind of mentor me and, you know, teach me how to make pie. And it's those kind of little things that were really nice for me. And, you know, if you see kids like that, have them over. And it's just, it's part of relationship building that I think is irreplaceable.
Victoria Hughes with the Bill of Rights Institute. I wanted to ask the panel's thoughts on this idea. We're sitting here in the city of Philadelphia where the founders gave us a constitution that was a plan for limited government. And I think if they were to be with us today, they would be truly shocked at what has been produced from their plan for limited government. And the conservative movement and the Republican Party have not done very much to produce a limited government. It is one thing where Ronald Reagan tried and failed to roll back the size of government, and we see that George W. Bush has greatly expanded our government. And I was wondering what this panel thought about the idea of fundamental government reform as a challenge for their generation that could unite the conservative movement the Republican Party, re-energize the Republican Party, and even bring back some of those independents that you were talking about in the West. So if the panel could respond to that, I'd be grateful.
Well, I don't know what exact government reform ideas you're talking about. I mean, I guess term limits comes up fairly often. I guess I'm agnostic, though not opposed on term limits, just because I've seen them at the local level, and it creates a permanent lobbying class and a very naive turnover of a very naive political class. I mean, the New York City Council is an amazing example of the downside of term limits. I think that the place where you can start getting more support for limited government among young people now is probably going to be entitlement reform. Chris Buckley just wrote his book Boomsday, of course. This is, where the big generational conflict is coming, is that people have gotten relatively comfortable with the size of government, but the generation, broadly speaking, sitting at this table is going to be crushed by the weight of the Social Security system. And I think that is at least one of the few issues where there's a significant political constituency that will eventually wake up to that fact and realize that we need to trim back that system and move more towards accounts or an ownership society type approach to that. But as far as permanently changing, really changing the size of government, I think there is some equilibrium that the government is probably going to keep doing a lot of the things it's doing right now. The question is to have it do it in a more market-based way and a less intrusive way. I just don't think, again, getting back to political calculus, that there's any political will out there to really trim down what the government does.
Nigel Ashford, Institute for Humane Studies. My original question was going to be for you to comment on the state of public opinion among the young generation, and to ask, in what ways do you think the young generation have conservative values and beliefs, and in what ways do they do not? The first question reflected some of that, and I noted the almost lack of response to that first part when you were asked in a sense, in what sense would the young generation have conservative values and beliefs. So I wondered if that meant that you didn't think the young generation have very many conservative values and beliefs, in which case you might want to answer the second part of my question, which was, in what ways do the current generation not have conservative values and beliefs, and what should the conservative movement do about that?
I'll start out on one social issue where the conservative generation, it's a question. I think they do have conservative beliefs. When you look at support for something like civil unions and gay marriage, you'll find that the younger generation, once you get to the section of the population under about 30 years old, somewhere between 40 and 30 years old, there's majority support for civil unions. And this is something that I think is going to be very important in shaping the political character of the next generation, and that the Republican Party has taken such a hard line in the opposite direction. I mean, we had this week the New Hampshire legislature passed a civil unions bill, which kind of forced the Republican candidates to finally take a position on this, because while Romney's position has been clear, McCain and Giuliani had been straddling the fence, and now both have come out in opposition to civil unions. So I think that's one area where that's what I was saying. I think that's a conservative view. People would probably want to characterize that as a liberal view, but I definitely subscribe to the school of thought that bringing gay couples, gay Americans into the institution of marriage or something very similar is actually a conservative revolution in our society. And so that's at least one issue I'll hit. Maybe other panelists have some others.
I will make a comment on just what might be appealing about liberalism to young people. I think a lot of it is people that are getting involved, they're going to do the campaign work essentially for Hillary Clinton, are just eager to kind of take down the majority. Republicans have been in power for a long time, and there are things with corruption, the entitlement spending, and they don't realize the effects of it, but they know they don't like what they're seeing now. And I think a lot of it is that because the leadership hasn't really articulated a message of small government conservatism and being hopeful and cheerful and we're going to give you that personal account we promised you, because that's what essentially attracted me to liking President Bush, because I thought I was going to get more of my money that I worked for. And we need to get back to that. This is what we have to offer as conservatives, because the liberals don't. But right now young people just want to, they're acting rebellious, they want to take it down, and I think it's just going to be, the typical, we need change that's going to carry the next election, unfortunately.
On your second point about the older generation, I think the biggest thing I noticed, and Ryan touched on this in his talk, is that conservatives have drastically gone off course on the economic front. This rise of crony capitalism, where you guys free market rhetoric with special interest groups and being in bed with big business, and what I mean by that is granting them handouts and closing barriers to entry. It's true there's decreases in taxes, but there's also massive increases in government spending. Again, this goes back to the entitlement point. And so on this issue of fiscal policy, I think it's a major issue. For the younger generation, I think one major thing to do, and I know a lot of this will surprise you given my background, but is economics and just basic economic education. And the Institute for Humane Studies does an amazing job instilling a lot of these values. But, you know, I teach this economics for the citizen course, and I just teach the basic economic way of thinking. There's no political ideology or anything like that. And when you just explain to students the benefits of voluntary exchange, the importance of private property rights for innovation, the process of wealth creation, they quickly learn the same point that Amanda Britt raised, which is Santa Claus doesn't drop down money for student loans or for any other government programs. In order to fund government programs, you have to take from productive people. You have to leech off productive people. And you either do that now or you put it off until the future. So the current administration is cutting taxes but increasing spending, and of course those bills will come due at some time, and you either raise taxes in the future or you cut government programs in the future. And like Ryan said, I'm somewhat pessimistic that there'll be a massive cuts in government programs, so I think that's going to pose a major problem in the future as well.
I'm Dennis Stevens. I'm a product of a lot of the groups represented in this room, from Leadership Institute, Heritage, Intercollegiate Studies Institute. I have many mentors in this room, Mother Denman and others. It's my impression that it's my conviction that we are about 25 years into a civilizational war, and that we have about 50 years to go. And there are people here today who are probably, hopefully, in the best case, going to see the end of that with the West victorious. I believe that we need all the institutions represented in this room and who were here earlier in the week to be successful over the next 50 years. I want to thank the people in this room who over the last 50 years helped create the institutions that helped get the ideas out there. From the tax folks to the life folks to the principled folks to people like Morton, who created the technological skills that turn people into angry people into sensible journalists. And we're going to need all of that, and we're going to actually need everyone represented here to redouble their efforts over the next 5 or 10 years to create that new generation who's going to be sweeping through over the next 10, 20, 30 years. I don't see any way out of this over the next 50 years except through a very, very, very committed, educated, honestly elite, represented by folks in this room. I just want to thank everyone for their participation.
Thank you. Please.
Hi, Bethany Lewis. I'm from Arizona State University College of Law. I had a question that I'm interested in hearing from all the panelists. It was slightly touched on already, but I wanted to ask you what you foresee as the future response to the gay rights agenda for younger conservatives. Particularly, will this issue destroy fusionism, both for traditionalists and libertarians in public policy, legislation like employment non-discrimination for gays, special admissions to schools for homosexuals, civil unions, marriage, and also in the law with expansive understandings of liberty that protect sodomy, and also with cases like Romer where the court will look at legislative intent and strike down legislation because they see animus toward gays. And do you think that's going to drive a wedge between traditionalists and libertarians in the future?
I guess since I've touched on it, I'll just add a little bit. I don't know. I think I might be speaking too close that causes that awful feedback we've been getting. I think that the way it doesn't divide traditionalists and libertarians is if traditionalists and libertarians could come to agreement on essentially taking a federalist approach to this. I think that something like the Federal Marriage Amendment is, first of all, very destructive just legally, but I think it's also very destructive politically. I don't see any reason marriage law shouldn't be regulated by Vermont and Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire any way they choose. Now, there's a separate issue within each state about the judiciary overreaching, but that's not actually where the movement is anymore. We're actually starting to see the first round of civil union laws passed with absolutely no court interference, and those two states are Connecticut and New Hampshire, where the courts were completely uninvolved, and the citizens came to the conclusion through the legislative process that they wanted to have civil unions. So as long as traditionalists and libertarians and the Republican Party could come to some peace that Alabama's not going to have that and Vermont and New Hampshire are, I think we can avoid a bloody fight on that within the party. If it has to be an all-or-nothing solution, yeah, we're going to see a war, and a war where a lot of younger conservatives can't stay in the party.
To answer, I think the first part of the sort of political legal question is whether or not what it portends for the future. I think it is good that those laws recognizing some form of civil union are going to be passed in most states and widely upheld. I think Ryan is right that if there's any hope for a continued alliance between more traditional conservatives and libertarians, it will have to be on some agreement that states should be allowed to do what they want and have a patchwork of laws. I don't know if the logic of either of those conservative camps would allow that, but I think that remains to be seen as a matter of political compromise.
One thing also to keep in mind is that I think libertarians and traditional conservatives are actually more united on this than you might think, but for very different reasons. Traditional conservatives because of moral issues, and libertarians because they don't think the state should be involved in marriage at all. I know a lot of libertarians actually voted against the gay marriage amendments, but not because they viewed it as necessarily morally wrong, but just because they don't think the state should be involved in marriage either way.
Amanda?
Yeah, I will add one point. I think it's funny, just offhand, that liberals are the only one that would want the government to regulate their marriage. But what the trend I've been seeing with tracking a lot of Hillary Clinton's involvement with the special interest group is that they're actively lobbying a lot of the larger employers, corporations, to get civil unions somewhat approved through insurance policies in a private way, which is actually a very, outside of the government way to go around this. So if you get so many large employers to grant some kind of status for this, union, marriage, whatever the employer calls it, if the special interest groups continue to use private employers to define how they'll use that, then that gives them an automatic plan to start lobbying the government for. And I think that's the way that it will muscle out. So however, like Google defines that they're going to handle this through insurance policy, that will be the plan that they take and lobby the government for. So I would watch that just in the newspapers as this continues to develop.
Good morning. Andrew Alabastro, Edelman Public Relations. I think we've touched on this a little bit, but conservatives and libertarians need to look for allies where maybe we haven't looked in the past. I know no liberals who like No Child Left Behind because it's not funded, and I believe that in electoral politics we may be able to find a way to extend that and seek the end of the Department of Education, which Mr. Sager pointed out we used to talk about, we don't anymore. The other point I would make is that for the corporate clients that I have, we found that businessmen, businesswomen, CEOs are more influential than the government and the media in most developed countries. We should cultivate them. We should reach out to them. We should bring our conservative ideas to them, libertarian ideas to them, that may have greater influence than we think. And I'd be interested in the panel's thoughts on that.
I mean, the best example, I think, of what you're talking about with the left and corporations is the green energy shakedown that's going on right now. And, you can buy a carbon credit. And certainly a lot of, I think especially in the energy industry, are sympathetic to the left on that issue simply because there's no conservative business interest sticking up for them to say no, global warming, the science isn't there. there's nobody sticking up for them in those communities. And, if you can make a, $50,000 donation to whatever group just to make them go away, I mean, that's a lot of the strategy that the environmental groups at least, and that's supported. And yeah, we should go in there and stick up for those guys because we need them as much as they need us.
Yeah, I mean, business tends to be very self-destructive just because they're so allergic to controversy that the left has a lot easier time shaking them down than we would. Now, I guess maybe the idea isn't to shake them down, it's to have them as allies, and we've seen that in the school choice movement. We've seen businessmen like Ted Forstman fund the Children's Scholarship Fund, private voucher programs, essentially, and we've seen a corporation like The Gap, one of the founders there, is one of the biggest funders of the KIPP charter school program, which some of you might be familiar with, just a fantastic program that has some great schools in New York. So we'll probably make a lot more progress trying to use conservative philanthropy and business philanthropy to promote our ends than any sort of, you know, trying to co-opt them politically. I think that's much more difficult.
Certainly, the Atlas Economic Foundation is working overseas to bring conservative libertarian ideas to people around the world. Certainly, the Resource Bank reaching out as it does to international organizations and experts. So we are beginning and continuing to have, I think, an increasing impact around the world, which leads us to our last questioner, who I think is from overseas.
Yes, I'm from Portugal, from the Catholic University. If I understood Mr. Evans' lecture yesterday, he said that the conservative movement was built on ideas. He said that there were books and there were people who read those books. He said that the movement began at the intellectual level and then to the practical level, because when you have ideas firmly held, you can change the terms of debate. And I would like to ask you if you feel the same might be happening to the younger conservative generation. Are you reading those same books than the older generation? Are you keeping the conservative principles firmly held by reading those books and educating? Thank you.
Well, I mean, there's been a certain degradation of, as people have talked about recently, we've gone from Bill Buckley to Ann Coulter and Michelle Malkin, and I think that is a tragedy for conservatism, but you know, programs like this and a lot of good programs keep people reading the classics, and more of that is always good.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the problem with sort of a conservative reading public is the same as it is for any reading public. There is more and more to read, and as the movement has grown and ramified, people have become more specialized in their reading, and there's less and less of a common core of books. But I think that, as Ryan mentioned, people around these tables know that a lot of those books remain in print and remain important, and that as long as the discussion is continuing, those books will hopefully will continue to be in circulation.
I'm actually a huge optimist with this because with the internet now, I mean, places like Liberty Fund and organizations like that are actually putting these texts online in addition to making them available at a very cheap price. So I'm very optimistic that spreading the word through the internet will have a huge impact. I think a lot of this is just, it's random. It's luck. It's bump. For me, for instance, just having a professor that is very much into this these ideas and gives you a copy of the book or recommends you to some kind of seminar or organization, then you go to their website and check it out, and you go from there. But yeah, I'm a very big optimist because of the internet with all of this.
Just put in a plug, if I will, that the Heritage Foundation has just published Reading the Right Books, a heritage guide for the conservative intellectual. And we had hoped to have copies available at this meeting, but most, if not all of you, will be getting copies of that. It's an annotated list of 101 modern conservative classics, not all conservative books as well. I think you'll find that very useful in terms of expanding your reading. Let's come down to our last two questions, if we may. Thank you.
My name is Roman Ioka. I'm from the Civic Institute in Prague, Czech Republic. I would like to make a few comments on Mr. Christopher Coyne's remarks regarding foreign policy of classical liberalism. I would mention the European experience, especially of that European country which is perhaps closest to the United States, and that is United Kingdom, Great Britain. If I'm correct, classical liberals or Whigs in the history of England and Britain were very good at establishing freedoms, individual freedoms, political freedom at home. They cut taxes, cut spendings, introduced religious freedom, freedom of the press, and so on. But from time to time, in the period of crisis, they were quite weak on defending British freedoms against foreign enemies, and British Tories were quite good at preserving and even extending British freedoms abroad. I would mention William Pitt the Elder. In the first half of 18th century, there was a weak oligarchy. They cut taxes, cut spendings. Then the war, seven years of war came, and British were, they were not able to produce defenses against French. And William Pitt emerged, and he led Britain to victory. Again, at the end of the 18th century, there was French Revolution. Many Whigs were very clairvoyant and prudent, like Edmund Burke. They saw the danger and, in fact, called for something like an international crusade against the French Revolution. Other Whigs, unfortunately, like Charles James Fox, were very naive and even very sympathetic to the French Revolution. Then came William Pitt the Younger. He was the guy able to forge a coalition of European powers against one military dictator who would be disastrous for the future of freedom on the European continent, Napoleon. We can mention Winston Churchill, of course.
Well, I know, but how long?
the final comment. It seems to me that Whigs and
Margaret Thatcher
were able to establish freedom at home, but many times it took Tories to defend it against foreign enemies. Would you agree with that position?
Given the little I know about this, I guess I would agree. I'm not an expert on that, so I'll take your word for everything you said. My point is more focused on the United States. And just to get a plug in, I have to have a book just like everyone else on the panel. In November, I have a book coming out called After War, The Political Economy of Exporting Democracy, which applies the tools of economics to nation building, focusing on U.S. occupation and nation building. And it's a positive analysis. It's not normative, although there are moral aspects to it. But I view nation building as a massive exercise in central planning. The U.S. has been largely unsuccessful at it because it represents a massive government failure. One thing I've always been surprised at with many conservatives is they're very skeptical of government's ability to provide things domestically at a much smaller level, education, social security, and so forth. But then when it comes to foreign interventions and military occupations, somehow that goes out the window, and we think that they can centrally plan the extended order, not just of a small social program, but political, social, and economic institutions. So I'd use the tools of economics to show why I don't think the United States can do this, given the knowledge problem that policymakers face, as well as the incentives created by the U.S. Political system. So would I agree with what you said? Yeah, to the extent that I know about what you said. But I'm not sure if there's any other question there that I can actually answer.
I'd just say that certainly traditional conservatives like Robert Taft and even Barry Goldwater was not for nation building, nor was Ronald Reagan for that matter. Please.
I have two very brief questions. I'm Matt Brogdon from Baylor University. I'm a doctoral student there. And I've noticed in my students that perhaps the dichotomy that we highlight here between traditionalists and libertarians is a bit muddied whenever it comes to my average student. And I do have quite a few conservative students. Of course, it is in the Deep South. And I found that the way that my students like to approach dealing with these issues of gay marriage, of the welfare state entitlements, and so forth, is indeed federalism. My first question that I would pose to you is, I teach American political thought, and so we deal a great deal with these political developments and so forth. And I find my students do want to simplify federalism the way I think is being suggested here, that we can just simply do things our own way in Florida and New York and Texas. And so my question is, one, we do have a full faith and credit clause that does complicate that. We do have an integrated legal system, like it or not. I'd like you to suggest to me, I'd like your perspective, because a couple of you seem to be quite active and live in the D.C. area and so forth. Who do you see as perhaps rising stars in American conservatism that you think might be able to bring some sort of synthesis, some sort of cohesive Republican platform that would win a majority and be able to achieve some of these ends that we've specified? Thank you.
I mean, I think the way you deal with the federalism question is we already have, you know, as you said, a full faith and credit clause, and a complicated legal issues are always arising under this. So what you'd want to see is restraint from the federal courts, and the federal courts not forcing recognition. I mean, I think the Federal Defense of Marriage Act was a fine step in that way, not requiring other states to recognize what one state might do. They were trying to head off Hawaii, which didn't end up happening, but now that's in effect for the states that do have gay marriage and civil unions. So, you know, judges, as always, matter. Strict constructionist, federalist judges who will, you know, not, and I think our current Supreme Court certainly wouldn't go out of its way to, you know, force states to recognize gay marriage or civil unions. That's probably not something the Roberts Court would be accused of being eager to do. And I'm terribly afraid I forget the second part of the question. What was
it? I'm living in Washington.
Oh, who's a rising star? Mike Pence is one, and Fred Thompson if he gets in the presidential race.
I sort of agree with Ryan. I think that if a federalist solution becomes possible, I think that the courts will hopefully see that this is a sensitive issue, and that surely the terms from state to state are going to vary on what's permitted, will come to some way of operating that does not impinge upon different states' way of doing things. I think that the more direct threat is not so much that once people agree to a federalist solution, everyone will agree that states can do it differently, but that the logic of rights that's inherent in this discussion is not going to brook any state borders. And so it will mutate from a federalist discussion to a discussion of, well, what is granted must be a right, and a right must be universal. And I think that that's going to be the problem faster than a federalist problem.
One could add to that, if you have the right president who makes the right nominations to the Supreme Court to join those whom we have there already, federalism is going to be strengthened. I would like, I'll take the prerogative of the chair and just ask for one very brief answer from all of our panelists. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future?
Optimistic.
Optimistic.
Generally optimistic long term, but concerned about 2008.
Cautiously optimistic under the aspect of eternity.
Well, and that Kirkian answer, let's ask. Well, I think we're in pretty good hands, ladies and gentlemen, for the future. Thank you so very much. Thank you, Bill Campbell. Thank you, George Nash. Have a safe trip. God bless.